One very hot and very humid evening in July 2013, at dusk, a small group of SUNY Oswego students joined biological sciences professor Jen Olori for a night of frog wrangling at Rice Creek Field Station. The temperature was in the high 80s, the humidity not far behind. Mosquitoes were ferocious, frogs were abundant, and the frog wranglers were determined to have a successful outing. The purpose of this trek, one of several held throughout the year, was to inspect captured frogs for parasites, abnormalities, and other visible signs of distress, and to take toe samples and skin swabs for lab analysis to determine to what extent, if any, the local amphibian population may be infected with certain viruses and other maladies. Voices you'll hear include Julia Yurko, Kirsten Mihalik, Kaylee Wilson, and Zachary Hall. Professor Olori sets the scene.
We've started a long-term monitoring program to help look at the health and status of the local amphibian populations here. We know that worldwide there's been a decline in frogs and salamanders, and also Sicilians, which are a lesser-known group of amphibians. And even though there's been some anecdotal evidence that there aren't as many species or as many individuals of certain species around here in the Northeast, there really isn't a lot of hard data to really know what's going on as far as the status goes. And also around the world, a lot of the declines have been linked to some new emergent diseases, such as the chytrid fungus, and also rhinovirus, which is fairly new, and that affects both amphibians and, as we're finding out, some reptile species also. So what my students here are doing right now are looking for frogs and salamanders right in our backyard to see if some of these diseases are actually present in our local populations, because people have kind of overlooked local areas when there was kind of a rush to figure out what was going on with extinctions in more exotic places like Central America and Australia. So one of the most important things in this study is to prevent cross-contamination, not only between different individuals, such as if one frog is infected but others may not be, but also to make sure we're not getting any potential disease-causing agents on any of the equipment. So you'll notice the students are very careful about wearing gloves and changing gloves. We can only really process one individual at a time. So we'll put them all into holding containers, and then everyone will change their gloves.
So we're here at Rice Creek, and we're right at the edge of a pool. And it looks like we're having some success picking up some frogs. What have you got?
Green frog. It's an adult male green frog.
Now, you're putting them in a plastic bag. Did you do some kind of observation before you did that?
We will do the observation after he's in the bag.
So the bags are used for a couple of reasons. Okay. One is, again, it prevents cross-contamination with equipment and also just between individuals. But the other thing is that it actually calms them down a little bit, so they're easier to handle after they've been in the bag and have kind of relaxed.
Well, these bags are sandwich bags.
Pretty much. Two sizes of amphibians, snack size and sandwich size. And that's literally how we figure out what size we need for certain animals. And by the way, it doesn't hurt them at all, because their metabolism's so much lower. They're okay in the bags for a long time. Do you have the other one in the bag?
Yeah, I do.
All right, so you can either sit out entirely and hold.
Or just switch gloves?
Switch gloves.
All right.
We'll have to keep an eye on them. They can actually hop away while they're in those. So
you can just, if you want to wait, because I can do the toe clip and the spot.
Okay.
Do you need new gloves?
No, I'm just going to set up for this one.
He's touched that animal, so he can't touch this one.
Can't touch the other ones.
Correct.
Okay. And that's his animal to work with here?
Well, we do it as a team. Generally, there have to be at least three or four students to process an individual. And you'll see that they have different jobs. So, for example, right now, Kaylee is a frog wrangler, so she will actually handle the animal. And generally, there are two people to do that, just because they can be a little feisty sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you'll notice that Kirsten and Julia are the clean people, the sterile people. So Kirsten will handle the tools, and Julia will do the recording, and neither of them will touch the animal or anything the animal has come in contact with.
So you've already weighed it.
Yep, first we weigh it. And then we're going to take two measurements to make sure they're accurate from the snout to the cloaca, or the vent, just to see their length. And sometimes if you can't tell if they're a male or female or adult or sub-adult, you can tell by their length.
Are these typical adult size frogs?
Yes. Well, sometimes they're really small, so you can't tell if they're male or female. So, and it's also hard to tell if they are sub-adult or adult.
The other way you can tell with those guys is the males have a nice yellow throat during the breeding season. This only works with bullfrogs and green frogs, though.
So we are in the breeding season as we speak?
We are for those two species. You've missed the peepers, you've missed the tree frogs, I think, they just wrapped up at the end of June usually. I mean, it depends a little bit on temperature, but the bullfrogs and the green frogs around here are some of our latest breeding amphibians. And they also have a prolonged season.
77.42 millimeters. The wind is like 79.42 in the second one.
This is a female green frog. You can tell because the tympanum is about the same size or smaller than the eyes, and there is no yellow under the throat.
Zach, you referred to the tympanum. What is that?
Tympanum is basically equivalent to like a human ear. They use it for listening for vibrations in the water.
It's basically exposed eardrum, like timpani drums,
mm-hmm.
Tympanum.
Makes sense.
Same root. So they don't have an outer ear like we do.
Mm-hmm.
There's no flappy pinnae.
Typically we do 5 on each foot, 5 on the stomach, 5 on the thighs, and 5 on the feet.
What are you doing? What do you say, 5 what?
5 strokes.
With the swab?
Yes, correct.
Did you get it?
Did you get it? No. I didn't click. Is this your first time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so move up just a little bit back, further back, so you get more toe.
There you go.
That's good.
There you go.
Get in there and open them. And electrophoresis.
Good job. We photograph every individual that we capture, partly just so we can check our own identifications, and that way if there's any question about the data sheet, we can actually look back at the photographs and match up the individual. And sometimes we photograph things like lesions, because that's actually an external symptom of rhinovirus, or anything else that's interesting or odd or ectoparasites, because again, we are looking at the long-term health of the population. So not just those two diseases, but how's everyone doing kind of as a whole.
Have you done enough research to know whether you're starting to see some of these parasites and viruses that you're testing for?
Well, we actually have just finished going through our samples from last year for the chytrid fungus, and we have about a 30% prevalence rate.
So you know that they're here?
Yes, in every species we've looked at, including the salamanders that we've captured, about 20 to 30% of the individuals have tested positive for chytrid. We have an honors thesis student, Rachel Carey, who is looking at rhinovirus, and I think she just got through her first round of molecular tests, and so she has some that preliminarily look like they're positive, but we don't have a prevalence rate yet for that, and she still has to go back and double-check all of those, make sure they're not false positives. But I wouldn't be surprised, because I believe that rhinovirus has been detected in some species of amphibians in other areas of the state, as well as box turtles last year for the first time.
Are they releasing them?
They release them in exactly the same place we captured them from. That's to help, not to disturb the animals. Basically, disturb them as little as possible. And then once they release that and change their gloves, they'll go back and look for other individuals.
Tiny green frog, but he was too fast.
So what have you got?
I have a small green frog, possibly a female. Once we do the measurements, we'll be able to tell if it's a subadult or an adult.
Now, is this pool an extension of Rice Creek, or is it a separate? Mm-hmm. Is it a pond?
On the map, this is marked as a vernal pool, which technically means that at least at some point of the year it should be dry enough that fish couldn't live in there permanently. So a lot of frogs and salamanders take advantage of that because it's a safer place to lay their eggs.
But with all the rain we've had this summer, this could be a vernal pool that's just got water in it later.
Correct. They don't have to dry out every year, just kind of on average. And this actually has less water in it than it did at about this time last year. And also, vernal pool might be kind of a misnomer. They're more like autumnal pools.
Kristen, 169 A and B.
Okay, thank you. And that's just the vial number for the swab and the toe clip.
There's the bumps.
They almost look like boils.
Yeah, it looks like. There's bumps, then there's a black spot right there.
Mm-hmm. Is the humidity 67%?
Yeah.
check it periodically because it will change as the sun sets. Yeah, that's interesting.
Do you know what that could possibly be?
It could be from ectoparasites. It could be skin lesions that have healed a little bit. I'm not sure. We actually haven't really seen this in anybody so far that I can think of.
We had that one that Zach and I found, the leopard frog.
That had the three ectos on its belly.
Yeah, they look like that one.
It actually looks like another bump right there, like a blackish.
You see that?
Could be ectoparasites.
Yeah, or it could be something that healed a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Like a scar tissue.
Mm-hmm. We'll get photographs of it. Put something in the notes section, basically describing what you guys just discussed for that. There's definitely a learning curve involved in handling, particularly the frogs, but salamanders can be quite slippery. They escape easily.
Must be harder with the latex gloves.
Yes, particularly if you have small hands.
Now, you just put something on the frog from a tube. What is that, Zach?
It's an antibiotic, so it prevents infections.
After the toe clip.
Underside first.
It doesn't matter. One underside, one ventral view, and
let's
one dorsal
underside.
View.
Okay.
I never got the time.
It's 22 after 8.
Thank you. Just take a few minutes off of it. Should be a little closer to the time we actually got. All right, same thing with dorsal view. So
there you go.
I just know I need to practice this because I'm not necessarily so great at it.
That's because you do all the important lab work. It's really nice when students can do both because then they can see where the actual samples are coming from. And then it's nice to do the lab work because it makes you pay more attention to what you're doing in the field.
Right, one of the things we learned about that specifically was the cotton swabs and making sure that they're not too big to close the cap because that skews the results in the lab.
How so?
Well, it just doesn't, the DNA doesn't separate properly, and so we end up not getting enough, or I just noticed it over a period of time, and I noticed the pattern of, it was always with those ones that were a little bit too long to go into the tube. So that's like one major thing that I've seen from doing the field work and from doing the lab work.
Now, have you shared that with other researchers?
Yep. We make sure when we find out stuff like that we like share it with the other people that are going out into the field, and we haven't had as much of a problem with it.
We have a pretty large research group. We have about 25 students who are sort of on call, who've been trained, and if they're available, they can come out and do things. Again, we have to have kind of a minimum of 3 or 4, but sometimes we've had 10 people come out, and so we just do 2 different groups, and it works really well. And then we have about 4 students who've been trained to do the lab work.
Should have asked this question at the beginning. What are the circumstances of this research? Are these students in a class? Are they working on a research project specific to what they're doing?
Actually, most of these guys are volunteering their time. They aren't even getting credit for it. I have a couple of student researchers who are part of the Summer Scholars Program who started out on this project, actually, and are working for me on another related problem. But most of them are volunteer. They volunteer their time. They don't get paid. They don't get credit for it. A few have worked separate aspects of it, like the rhinovirus testing into an honors thesis. So there's potential there for totally independent research as well. But for the most part, it's a team effort. And it's not glamorous, but usually it's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, Julie indicated she works in the lab. Are these all biology majors?
Pretty much biology and zoology.
Zoology.
Yep. We've got a pretty even mix of both, I think, among all of the students that are participating. And we also have a few faculty members who join us now and then just because they really enjoy doing it as well.
Now, are they looking for additional specimens here?
They are, and as you can see on hot days, you know, it takes a little courage to get in the water at first, but usually once somebody gets wet, then they go in there.
Yep.
That looks good.
We got them.
Okay. All right.
I just, I don't dare let go of them right now.
You guys want to come in and process this frog?
It's deeper than splits.
And
then as soon as you turn around, it follows you right back. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not as if they disappear. It's just that their breeding season is earlier, April and May, and so they stop calling. But you can still find them.
Peepers are the frogs that you hear first thing once the snow melts, sometimes even before it's completely melted. Is that correct?
Pretty much, yep. They can actually do quite well in temperatures as low as 40 degrees Fahrenheit. So, yes, they're usually the first things you hear, although if you're very lucky and you live near some vernal pools in the woods, you might hear some wood frogs. They're also one of the early breeding frogs.
Good.
I think I read that, is it American frogs or American toads that are, like, resistant to the BD, but they carry it?
Bullfrogs.
Bullfrogs, okay. There's something else that I read that was resistant to it.
Tiger salamanders.
Yes.
Are one, yeah. So we've been finding that there are a couple of species that will carry the chytrid fungus but don't present any symptoms and don't die from it. And at least two of our local species fall into that category. Bullfrogs, which are really common, they're actually classified as vectors for chytrid now.
Definitely.
And tiger salamanders, which in New York State you really only find kind of in the Long Island area. You're not going to find them up here.
Something
but.
What do you mean by that term, vector?
Vector in the sense that they can carry it and spread it to other populations, but it doesn't harm them. Do you guys want to explain the frog wrangling a little bit? How you actually maintain control of them safely?
I'm trying my best because this is the part that I feel the least confident with, and I actually let one go the last time, but we got it. What I'm doing is holding the legs there, but when we first put it in there, we kind of have to make sure our hands are up into the bag so he doesn't hop out. And then we keep him in the bag for the weighing and the measuring. And then I'm going to point his nose towards this part of the bag and try to pull him out.
Okay, you're pointing his nose to the corner of the bag.
Yeah, so he, just so he doesn't anticipate me opening the bag, and hopefully I'll be able to pull him out. And I'll do that by holding back here firmly.
Kind of have to imagine the frog having a little waist where the body tapers just before the legs. And usually if you can get a firm but gentle grip there, you can keep them from kicking out with their legs. It's a pretty safe way to handle them, and actually we've had a couple frog whispers in the group, and if you gently put the frog on its back, it will actually calm down to the point that it will just lay there still while you swab it and measure it and all of that.
Holy moly! This one is 90.85 millimeters.
We've caught larger ones. Not to downplay your achievement here.
That's an interesting point. Are they smaller in the north than they are in the south? I mean, I've seen some frogs that are just absolutely huge in the Carolinas and Florida.
It probably has a stronger relationship with species. So the green frogs don't get as large as bullfrogs.
I don't see any.
For a lot of ectotherms, which are sort of what we think of as, cold-blooded organisms, it is true that when they have warmer conditions, they have a longer growing season, if you want to think of it that way. They can get larger over time because they're making better use of the energy from that. But I think the bigger difference will be among species, kind of the habitat they're living in.
Are there any unique markings?
Nope, I'm not observing any. She looks pretty normal.
A unique marking would be something like if the frog was missing a leg, just naturally had a deformity like that, or if it had a really obvious pattern difference compared to other frogs. I mean, they all have their unique pattern, like a fingerprint, but some of them have certain little shapes and blobs that are very distinct. We had one a couple weeks ago where one eye was much larger than the other, so that was pretty unique.
This one's really, really active. There
we
go.
Much more active when it's warm out. Much easier to handle them in March and April when they're still adjusting to the weather.
Now you're all out here enduring all of this mosquito swarming. Do you have to be here under these circumstances? I mean, is this an ideal time?
Yeah, they're most active and easier to find in the evenings, any time of the year, really. Especially during the breeding season, they're most active about a half an hour after sunset, through maybe a couple hours beyond that. It's like peak calling, all sorts of things. So unfortunately, it's also peak mosquito time. You can find them during the day, but it's a lot more difficult. They tend to be a little more secretive. We actually find once the males start calling, they're almost like sitting ducks because the only thing they care about is finding a mate. Mm-hmm. So you can just reach out and grab them with your hand once they start calling. But they're much more wary when it's still light out. also an expert in frog portraits now. It's a skill I never thought I'd have. But
look at that fat belly.
It does.
She's puffed up because she would like you to let go of her. All right, dorsal view, please. Okay. It's very nice. All right, okay, a little side view. Just
oh, sorry.
Oh, it's okay. You guys can do that part first if you want. Doesn't matter.
Any other notes?
I'm gonna let her go.
So you weigh the bag each time also?
Yes. Since we weigh the frog inside of the bag, in order to determine the actual weight of the frog, we have to measure the bag.
2.7. Remember also, if you guys see any tadpoles in there, we can sample them as well.
Did you?
No. Well, I think there's a frog over there.
They've been everywhere. I've been walking back and forth here. Yeah, I'm still just looking for a peeper.
Yeah, that was a green frog. There's one right there.
Is that a green frog or a peeper? A half a dozen over here. Got one?
I got one. I caught my first frog.
Did you get one?
Caught one. By hand. It's a lot easier.
No, no, you have to check to make sure it's not one we've already gotten.
Oh, no, we haven't.
Okay. Check the back feet, too, because last year we clipped the back legs. Nope, looks good. All right.
It's my first frog. I'm so happy.
There is something magical about that. I mean, most students really are excited to get started, but once they actually catch their first frog, that's when you got it. Then they keep coming back to help.
Well, it happened on the 16th of July, 2013, at a quarter of nine.
Very nice.
At the conclusion of the collection and sampling process, all frogs were released, and a formal decontamination procedure was undertaken. All equipment, including frog nets and boots and waders, were sprayed down with a 10% bleach solution, allowed to sit for 5 to 10 minutes, and then rinsed with water. The group travels with two pump sprayers and a large plastic tub with a lid for catching the waste solutions. Our thanks to SUNY Oswego Biological Sciences Professor Jen Allori and students Julia Yurko, Kirsten Mahalik, Kaylee Wilson, and Zachary Hall for allowing us to tag along. I'm Mike Amy. To learn more about frog wrangling and other activities underway at Rice Creek Field Station, see the Rice Creek Field Station webpage at oswego.edu.